Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. We volunteers at KABU are so thankful that the station is continuing to provide relevant information and wonderful music to help us maintain through this pandemic, and we're sure you share our feelings. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, KABU has had to cancel our spring pledge drive. But you can still help us through these difficult times. Please consider becoming a member of KABU or renewing your membership by going to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right corner of the homepage. While the world is focused on the COVID-19 pandemic, the nuclear and fossil fuel industries are keeping busy trying to slip through their latest devious plans. But activists are on to them, even from their socially distanced locations. Today we talk again with Dan Sears, Columbia Riverkeeper's conservation director, about radioactive fracked waste that has been illegally dumped in Arlington, Oregon, while at the same time the Trump administration is trying to loosen the requirements for cleaning up the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, one of the most toxic places in the world. Dan, welcome back to Locus Focus.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
What do you perceive as being some of the biggest threats that we're seeing now that most of us are focusing on this pandemic and how to keep our community safe? What do you see that's coming out of the federal government and also other parts of the fossil fuel and the nuclear industry that are of great concern to you?
Yeah, there's been quite a bit of reporting on the nationwide level that what we're seeing from the federal administration at this time is rather than them pausing really important public processes surrounding, for instance, pipelines for conveying fracked gas to export facilities or railroad-related safety rules, what we see them doing is actually pushing forward proposals that would roll back protections for health and for safety of the communities that are affected by these types of developments. And so there's a couple really blunt examples here in the Northwest that have come forward just in the last several weeks that people are probably familiar with. But I think the common denominator here is the Trump administration is barreling ahead, trying to push forward some of these projects that are very damaging to the environment, to the stability of our climate, and to the health and safety of the communities where they're located. And the first and most obvious one has been, the Calama project, the methanol refinery in Calama, which received approvals from the Army Corps of Engineers many months ago, and we are in the process of challenging those approvals. But just in recent weeks, we've actually seen the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission put out just a two-week period for public comment on the pipeline that would be used to feed that Calama methanol refinery. And similar to the situation in Southern Oregon, where FERC really rushed to push forward an approval for the Jordan Cove-related Pacific Connector pipeline. In Calama, we're still waiting to see what FERC does with all the comments it received. But it is the experience of people all over the United States that rather than seeing a slowdown with these environmental damaging projects, we're actually seeing an acceleration.
What is that an indication for you of what the true agenda is of the Trump administration?
It's just remarkable that at a time when we're in the midst of a public health crisis and a pandemic, and in the midst of a time when oil prices have intermittently gone negative, that is, there is so much oil that oil companies will pay you to take it from them, that we're still seeing the Trump administration push forward huge rollbacks and giveaways to the fracking industry. One could argue that there's no more obvious subsidy to a company or to an industry than giving away private property to them or granting these industries the right of eminent domain. And so that's what's happening right now in Southern Oregon and Calama, Washington, where people are facing the prospect of eminent domain, the seizing of an easement through their land on a permanent basis to establish a new fracked gas pipeline. And while most people would think, we're in the midst of a pandemic, people are having to physically distance from one another to remain in their homes, you would sort of expect these processes to slow or to even stop. Rather than doing that, the FERC actually approved the Pacific Connector pipeline just a few weeks ago and may do the same with the Calama Lateral Pipeline, despite strong opposition from local landowners, environmental advocates, and even some concern about the ratepayer impacts of these projects. So it's very clear that given the situation that freebies for the fossil fuel industry is a high priority for the Trump administration. They seem to have no lack of enthusiasm or time to devote to trying to push these very destructive projects forward.
A lot of our listeners are probably pretty familiar at this point with the Pacific Connector gas pipeline, which would feed the frack gas to Jordan Cove LNG. However, I'm not as sure as many listeners are familiar with the Klamath Lateral Pipeline. So why don't you explain a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, the Klamath Lateral Pipeline is a 3.1-mile pipeline spur, essentially, off of the main line that comes down the I-5. So Williams Northwest Pipeline has proposed this 3.1-mile pipeline, and it was quite controversial because it goes through part of a cemetery, a very historic cemetery in Klamath, Washington. And so the people who steer that cemetery district have been vocal critics and even opponents of having that pipeline go through. It's an unusual alliance in Klamath of people who are very concerned about the health and safety of the community that don't like to see this project go forward from the methanol refinery perspective. But there's also people who take property rights very seriously, and they don't like the idea of eminent domain being used to benefit a private corporation just to export fracked gas in the form of methanol. So there's no compelling local public need for this 3.1-mile pipeline. It would be entirely devoted to shipping gas to a refinery that would make and refine methanol and then ship that methanol overseas. That's the plan for Klamath from Northwest Innovation Works. And what we're seeing is a very unusual and strong alliance between people with very different political perspectives who, for whatever reason, whether it's property rights or concern for the climate, they can see clearly that the Klamath methanol refinery is not a solution to those problems and, in fact, will exacerbate the impacts that people would see in Klamath. And so we're really just trying to support and empower these folks. You know, we put in our own comments urging the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to deny another 2 years of eminent domain authority that Williams Northwest Pipeline has requested. You can learn more about the pipeline by looking at the videos that are on the Columbia Riverkeeper website on our Klamath page. And it's a really beautiful part of Washington where this pipeline would come through. It obviously doesn't come close to the destruction level that we see proposed with the Pacific Connector pipeline just by virtue of the length of that pipeline in Southern Oregon at 230 miles. It would do an enormous amount of damage, but the Klamath Lateral, only being 3.1 miles, still manages to hit this very sensitive, beautiful spot, this cemetery. It doesn't go through actual graves, but it goes through the cemetery property. So we're hoping, but not expecting, that FERC might decline to grant 2 years of additional eminent domain authority. But given the track record of FERC, what we've seen with Jordan Cove LNG and with the Pacific Connector, we are sort of expecting the worst and hoping for the best.
I was talking with Larry Magnin yesterday, who's one of the landowners being impacted by the Pacific Connector pipeline. And he was saying that now that FERC has given the go-ahead, at least for eminent domain to start, that people workers could be coming on the land of people whose property the pipeline will go through. These people could be spreading COVID-19. It seems like there's so much lack of concern about the real dangers that we're living through right now with this pandemic, and that FERC, on the other hand, is just kind of doesn't seem to be caring about those issues either.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that concern, the connection with COVID-19. And I think what people do experience and have experienced in other pipeline situations, say in like Pennsylvania or in West Virginia, where we're seeing other pipelines proposed and constructed, is, you know, once the eminent domain authority is exercised by the company, they actually have control over that right of way while they're doing construction. And they can even restrict the local property owner's ability to go and be on that portion of their land. So while the pipeline is being built through the cemetery district, no one would be allowed to, you know, be close to it, the pipeline construction. It's a disturbing experience for people. I mean, if you get a chance to talk with landowners who've had a pipeline come through their private property, it's very disconcerting, disempowering, destructive even to have this huge imposition of a major piece of fossil fuel infrastructure on private land. And that's the reason why in most cases when eminent domain is contemplated, when a government agency is considering taking land in this way, they have to show a compelling public need, a public necessity even for the project. So think of a sewer line that's broken. They need to put in another one in your community. Rather than being something that's publicly needed and necessary, what we have in both the Kalama Lateral and the Pacific Connector gas pipeline are two pipelines that would be exporting fracked gas to overseas markets. In the case of the Pacific Connector in Southern Oregon, they'd be exporting that fracked gas, mostly from Canada, as liquefied natural gas. In the case of the Kalama project, the Kalama Lateral would be facilitating the export of fracked gas also from Canada in the form of methanol. So the meta proposal here is to uncork the west coast of the United States and allow huge quantities of fossil fuels to flow to overseas markets through Kalama, through Jordan Cove LNG. And that's the reason we see this really unusual alliance of people fighting on property rights grounds, standing alongside people who are very concerned for the climate. Because we know it's a nightmare for the local landowner, particularly those who haven't been browbeaten into signing off yet. And then we also know it's a huge impact on the climate. Now, these are two camps of interest that don't often overlap, but when it comes to pipeline issues, they overlap and they can be a very powerful political force. And we've seen that over and over again in Oregon, where, you know, it was an unusual alliance of farmers and foresters who worked with environmental advocates to stop hundreds of miles of pipeline that were proposed to feed LNG export facilities on the Columbia River.
Well, I understand that Ron Wyden has actually come out very strongly demanding that FERC basically have a moratorium on any new permits until the pandemic is over. Are you familiar at all with what Wyden has been proposing and if there's any chance that he might have any impact on FERC?
Yeah, we're hopeful that, you know, his position on this project and his pressure on FERC will give them pause about whether to allow eminent domain to continue for a project that no one wants or needs. What's really interesting is Senator Wyden took this decision by FERC on the Pacific Connector gas pipeline in Southern Oregon, and he used that as an opportunity to come out against the project as a whole because he was alarmed at the process through which FERC approved that gas pipeline. I know that Senator Wyden, in seeing that statement, he expressed a deep concern for the landowners along the pipeline path. So far, we haven't seen FERC change its approach at all in response to the pressure from Senator Wyden. But one thing to remember, you know, if depending on how Congress shakes out in 2021, Senator Wyden is potentially in a position to be a very powerful committee chair. And his perspective on FERC and how they operate is one that may carry some weight in the next Congress in 2021.
So are you hopeful that this can be put on pause, particularly with Kalama? I mean, right now it's really just an extension that they're asking for. This pipeline isn't imminently going to be built yet. So what do you think you expect to see in the next few months?
Yeah, we'll see what happens with Kalama. In the next week or two, we would expect to see a decision from FERC about that Kalama Lateral Pipeline, that 3.1-mile spur down to the methanol refinery that's proposed. With the Pacific Connector Pipeline, the ball is a little bit in the court of FERC again. There are several parties that just this week requested a rehearing with FERC, essentially asking them to revisit their decision to approve that Pacific Connector Pipeline. Now, the appellants, the folks who filed for rehearing, were tribes, sovereign tribes from Southern Oregon, a coalition of conservation and landowner eminent domain advocacy organizations, many individuals along the pipeline route, and then surprisingly enough, the Pacific Connector gas pipeline in Jordan Cove LNG also appealed FERC's decision because it wasn't as clean a rubber stamp as they had hoped for. That was a bit of a surprise to see Jordan Cove LNG itself come in and ask FERC to remove or to weaken conditions that would have required the company to show that it met certain state standards for protecting the environment and for protecting clean water, drinking water, and public safety. So we're in a really strange spot with Pacific Connector, where the company itself didn't feel like FERC's rubber stamp was easy enough, didn't make the path forward easy enough for them. And so they're actually challenging it as well. From our end, we were really pleased to see not just Senator Wyden come in and express opposition, but we actually saw the state of Oregon file a really strong legal brief, this request for a hearing that they filed just a couple days ago on the Pacific Connector pipeline. Because the Coloma Lateral is in a pretty different phase of its potential development, the next step there is really a decision from FERC. And so we'll see what they do. And there's a cemetery district board that has weighed in opposition to that project, and they would potentially have standing to ask FERC to reconsider.
We're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper, about two dangerous radioactive waste sites in the Columbia River, one well-known and the other just discovered. And we just finished talking about the impetus of the Trump administration to try to push ahead two very unpopular pipelines, frack gas pipelines going through southern Oregon and southwest Washington. Well, let's move on to the radioactive waste issues. This, before all this, before the world changed a couple months ago, we were talking about doing a show about the fracked radioactive waste that's been deposited in Arlington, and that was going to be the show itself. But it seems like there's a different context now for we're even looking at that. But since probably most listeners aren't even aware that this is going on, let's do first a little bit of background on what's been happening at the Arlington waste dump.
I've had written on the top of my notebook for about 2 months now, remember Arlington. It's such an important story for people to realize and to realize what folks are up against in Arlington. Arlington, Oregon is a beautiful little community along the Columbia River. It's a place that if you're on your way, you know, to the Dalles, if you go a little bit further past Celilo, you would come to Arlington. And it's really a tremendously beautiful part of the Columbia River, the mid-Columbia, you know, between the dams there. And so what happened in a span of 3 years was Waste Management Incorporated owns and operates a company called Chemical Waste Management in Arlington. And Chemical Waste Management accepted over 2.5 million pounds of radioactive fracking waste. Now, this is also called TNORM, which is a short version of technically enhanced naturally occurring radioactive material. And essentially what it means is in the fracking process, what happens is they force fluids into the ground to fracture the rock to release methane or oil, methane being what most folks still call natural gas. We call it fracked gas because it comes from the process of fracking. So that injection of fluid into the ground will pick up whatever naturally occurring radioactive material is in there, certain isotopes anyway. It'll pick up certain isotopes that are soluble and can even concentrate them a bit. And so what gets pulled back up to the surface is this produced water that comes out of the fracking process. And some of that fluid moves through filtering systems because it will be either reinjected or reused in the fracking process. Those filter socks strain out a lot of the material that was in the fracking fluid. And those filter socks, if this is an area with high naturally occurring radioactivity in the ground, those filter socks will actually concentrate the radioactive contamination in that fracking fluid. And what Oregon received was mostly made up of spent filter socks from fracking going on in apparently in the Bakken shale formation of North Dakota. But this is not an issue that has only occurred in Oregon or even in Montana or Colorado or other states. We see this all over the United States where fracking is occurring. It is in some cases pulling up and concentrating certain types of toxic or even radioactive contamination and pollution. So Oregon was sort of unwittingly becoming a dumping ground for radioactive fracking waste going back for 3 years. And that dumping went unreported until a whistleblower from North Dakota, an anti-fracking activist who we still don't know who this anonymous person, but the state of Oregon has identified them as an anti-fracking activist. They called the Oregon Department of Energy and told them, "We know this stuff is going to Oregon. Do you know where it's going?" And that caused the state of Oregon to ask Chemical Waste Management what they were receiving and if they were receiving fracking waste. During the course of that investigation, it became clear that Chemical Waste Management had illegally accepted material that never should have been dumped in Oregon, that flatly contradicts what Oregon's allowable level of radioactivity is. And so this broke in a series of stories from the Oregonian and from OPB going back in late February and early March. The last big activity that happened around this was on March 4th, 2020, the Oregon Department of Energy held or participated in a public meeting in Arlington. I was there, and what I heard from the people of Arlington very clearly was a feeling that they live in a beautiful community that doesn't deserve to be viewed as a radioactive dumping ground for fracked fossil fuel that really provides no benefit to that community. And so it was there were some very heartfelt, some hard-hitting questions. You can actually go on the Gillum County website and see and watch the Q&A from that March 4th meeting. It's up on the website. And it's pretty stirring to see people stand up and put very pointed questions to Chemical Waste Management and also to Oregon Department of Energy, who's taken some heat because they didn't find the company. They determined that although the law had been broken for a three-year period of time, the company was only discovered, you know, at one moment in time. So because the violation was caught all at once, this multiple set of violations, they consider that just to be a single violation under Oregon law. We actually think that's a mistake, and that Oregon does have authority to fine the company for illegally accepting radioactive fracking waste.
Even if the company had only done it once, why wouldn't that be reason for charging them and fining them and doing more extreme measures than that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the answer why the law was set up in a way to give a free pass for the first violation. And I should also say that a first violation, you can fine a company if it's determined that it was a willful violation or especially egregious. It's hard to believe that no one was aware that the radioactive fracking waste coming into Oregon might be a problem. It's hard to believe that a company who specializes in dumping and accepting all types of hazardous waste wouldn't know the rules in the state of Oregon, but that is their claim. Waste Management claims that they were confused by and unaware that what they were receiving violated Oregon's rules. This is, you know, clearly an unacceptable situation. And from our view, you know, the people of Arlington have been harmed by this. You know, we heard over and over in the town hall held on March 4th in the evening from people, you know, some of whom worked at the facility, that they were concerned that there was going to be a stigma for Arlington becoming known as a kind of radioactive dumping ground, that anyone who might think of relocating or spending a weekend up in Arlington would Google the place and suddenly find that it had become a dumping ground for radioactive waste. That's not the image that Arlington wants to project for itself. And it's certainly not something that should have ever happened without public knowledge, scrutiny. It's simply unacceptable that a company could use Arlington to dump 2.5 million pounds of radioactive fracking waste and face no fine for doing it. So we're continuing to look and see, you know, what avenues are open to the state of Oregon to get more control over the situation. What concerns me the most, and then I'll sort of stop with this long description, but during that meeting, one of the things that they pointed out is that the leachate from this landfill is collected at the bottom. The leachate is the
the liquid that kind of percolates through the lined landfill. And so it collects at the bottom, and they pump it out at the bottom. And when they pump it out, they take it to an open air evaporation pond. And so some of our concern is that this entire landfill was not designed to deal with radioactive waste. And what we see is this potential that if that leachate is picking up radioactivity and concentrating and moving it, it could be, there could be an exposure pathway via that open air evaporation pond. And that's a serious concern that really emerged out of that March 4th, 2020 town hall meeting. And I can't say enough how much I appreciate the people who were there in Arlington asking questions to try to shed some light on this new threat to their community. I mean, people clearly had just come from work, and you know, some of them still wearing their work clothes, and were there really to learn more and to try to advocate for their community.
One of the big concerns that I have is, aren't there like stringent measures taken to where you can even dump radioactive waste? Because you're sort of describing one of the problems, but it seems that what happens now that Arlington has all this radioactive waste and it's not really prepared to be able to contain it, and it wasn't supposed to be a radioactive waste site to begin with. I mean, we're going to move on to Hanford in just a moment, which is, you know, has its own problems, but radioactive waste sites, I had the impression, had much more stringent controls than regular disposal sites for our garbage.
You're correct. And I think that that was really, you know, again, to give credit to the people who asked the really good questions and that March 4th meeting, that was what most people were asking, is where do we go from here? And Oregon Department of Energy is going to hold a public process where they will ask for a corrective action plan from the company, Chemical Waste Management. Just, you know, I would predict that Chemical Waste Management doesn't want to go in and dig up this waste. So it's up to the public, really, to weigh in here and to be the countervailing argument. So either they need to dig up the waste and remove it, or they need to demonstrate that they would be able to manage the waste in such a way that it poses no public health or environmental threat. That's difficult to do with the way the landfill is currently managed, with its leachate management system involving an open-air evaporation pond. And so we're going to see in the coming months, probably after most of the physical distancing is lifted, we'll see if they try to do this via webinar or not. That would probably be difficult in Arlington to do this all via webinar. It seemed like people are willing to show up to actual in-person meetings for sure. There will be a corrective action plan. The public will have an opportunity to weigh in on this. And I can tell you, you know, right now, we're very concerned about the idea of abandoning this 2.5 million pounds of waste in Arlington. But just to be clear about the kind of scale of radioactivity, this is nowhere close to the radioactivity levels that we see at Hanford. So these are easily distinguishable. And, you know, we have for a long time appreciated and relied upon the Oregon Department of Energy to deal with and to advise the states of Washington and the federal government on how to deal with the very, very radioactive contamination at Hanford. So what Arlington has is not dangerous in the same way that the radioactive waste is at Hanford. It's simply not that radioactive. It's low-level radioactive waste. The concern, though, is that in an uncontrolled, if it's disposed of in a way that isn't very careful, you can have exposures to people in the public. You know, this is a place where there are very valuable wheat grown there. And what we heard from the community on March 4th was really a deep concern for their future and what is it going to mean to have that black mark on their record. That black mark is the words used by Chemical Waste Management to describe this mistake, as they put it. To their credit, I just want to acknowledge that Oregon Department of Energy was there to answer questions. They did their best to try to direct people to resources, and I would hope that as the corrective action plan comes forward, that there will be an open, transparent process for people all over the state to weigh in, but with a specific attention given to the people of Arlington, who really have the most at stake. as well as the Columbia River tribes, for whom, you know, this whole watershed is critical and has been for time immemorial. The idea of more of the Columbia River being used as a dumping ground for radioactive waste is really problematic for people all across the mid-Columbia.
We're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper, about two dangerous radioactive waste sites on the Columbia River. One well-known and the other one just discovered, which we've just been talking about, which is this turning Arlington into a low-level nuclear waste repository. Now, is there a concern that having already had this radioactive waste, even if it's low-level, dumped at the Arlington waste site, that now it would be an opener for other companies to come and dump more radioactive waste there?
That is a concern. You know, if these shipments came in and were dumped and no one knew the difference for more than 3 years, it does seem possible that other sites might have been used in this way. And in fact, you know, there's a great Rolling Stone article by an author named Justin Noble, who wrote a really compelling long piece about radioactive fracking waste and the impact it's having around the United States, not just in the Western United States, but also on the Eastern Seaboard. Our hope is that people can read that and get a better sense of the overall picture. To be clear, though, Oregon's rules are set up such that, you know, none of this waste should be coming to Oregon at all. And before the legislative process in Oregon really shut down and Republicans staged a walkout, there was a bill moving through the legislature to help Oregon Department of Energy tighten up its rules regarding radioactive fracking waste. That was something we were encouraged to see moving forward, and it was too bad that it didn't get through the 2020 session, which was, you know, basically halted by the Republican walkout. So our belief, our hope, is that going forward, you know, the state of Oregon will be on high alert and able to detect potential shipments like this coming in. But for now, it does seem like there is a bit of a gap, certainly in monitoring where this radioactive fracking waste is going. And to be blunt, you know, it costs a lot less to dump radioactive fracking waste in a dump that's not licensed to receive radioactive waste. It's a cost-cutting measure for the industry to dump this stuff wherever it's convenient. And we've, you know, that Justin Noble's piece in Rolling Stone is a really powerful expose into some of the consequences to workers and to communities of seeing this radioactive fracking waste dumped in their communities. So I really encourage people to look and to look that up and to read it.
It actually reminds me of issues around what they call midnight dumping, which were first uncovered back in the 70s, in the late 70s, kind of in the aftermath of the Love Canal fiasco. And I have this vague memory that waste management was involved, though I tried to do some research on that, and I couldn't find them directly linked to the midnight dumping. But it feels like this is the same kind of thing, and I'm sure that this has been going on in so many different areas for so long, where companies just have they just go ahead and dump really toxic substances, whether it's intensely toxic chemicals or, in this case, radioactive waste, in places that they're not supposed to do it. And I'm concerned that with all the focus right now on dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic, it's going to be hard for the state government, the legislature, and the Department of Energy to really come on and confront this as an issue that's like on their front burner.
That's a very valid concern. And what we, you know, would hope for, you know, there was one wheat farmer in, you know, Arlington who suggested, you know, why isn't the state of Oregon requiring them to at least, you know, pay into some kind of restoration fund, at least pay the amount that they were paid themselves to accept this waste illegally, or, you know, a dollar for every pound they dumped. You know, $2.5 million would potentially do some good to help ameliorate some of the impacts. But I think your concern is particularly well-placed here, because if the signal is you can dump this stuff in Oregon and not face a fine, that's alarming. That can't that can't continue. That can't be the way Oregon operates, because it was clear that the intent of Oregon's regulation is that none of this material should end up in Oregon. And so we don't need to rehash what Oregon standard is, really. We just need to make sure the enforcement capability is there and is effective to ensure that Oregonians don't get unwittingly dumped on with this radioactive fracking waste.
Well, to get more alarming, let's now talk about what's going on in Hanford.
Yeah, we're sort of spiraling downward here in this interview, but Hanford is really at a very important crossroads right now. And so it sort of stands alone in the United States in terms of its tremendous radioactive contamination. In fact, it is one of the most contaminated places in the world. It's kind of in league with Chernobyl and Fukushima in terms of the millions and millions of curies of radioactive contamination stored there and leaked there into the environment. So Hanford is a 586 square mile site that was used to produce plutonium for nuclear weapons. The process of making plutonium for nuclear weapons was very toxic, produced enormous streams, billions of gallons of radioactive contaminated wastewater. And we've come to a point with the Hanford site where some of the facilities that were built in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and onward are beginning to fail because they've simply reached the end of their engineering life, or they've been so irradiated by the waste they contain that they've sort of accelerated in their degradation and as they fall apart. So right now there's an open public comment period, and there's information on Columbia Riverkeeper's website addressing three places where the federal government sees an urgent need to go in and stabilize some of these aging structures. And to give you a sense for, how important this is, each, or at least a couple of these facilities involve contamination measuring in the tens of kilograms of plutonium. That's a lot of plutonium. It takes, roughly, something like 10 kilograms or probably even less to make of purified plutonium to make a nuclear weapon. And what we see remaining in some of these facilities that the federal government wants to address are up to 75 kilograms of plutonium, for instance, in one settling tank that they intend to stabilize. One of our big concerns about the way the federal government is approaching these dangerous, sort of degrading, aging facilities is they have sort of one solution for everything, which is to fill the structure with grout. It's sort of an engineered form of cement to give it more structural integrity. In doing that, our hope is that they should also be planning for the long-term removal, treatment, and disposition of that very dangerous waste. That we don't want to see grouting being used as an end point of cleanup, simply filling these structures with engineered cement and then walking away, because we know that the radioactive contamination within them will outlast the grout itself. Plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years, and it takes about 10 half-lives for most of the plutonium present to decay away, or for any radioactive isotope. It's kind of a rule of thumb. After about 10 half-lives, most of it is gone. And so you're talking 240,000 years of potential risk to the public from these facilities that contain quite a bit of plutonium. So one thing that we're doing right now is we're going to have a webinar on April 28th to raise more public awareness of this issue. We're working to try to get people to attend the webinar public hearing that they're holding, the U.S. Department of Energy. But it's only one piece of a much larger problem at Hanford, which is the longer stuff sits out there unattended. Well, I shouldn't say unattended. There are people, there are workers out there day in, day out, 24 hours a day, whose livelihoods involve essentially babysitting the legacy waste of making nuclear weapons from plutonium. I remember speaking with a tank farm worker who said, you know, it wasn't my life dream to babysit waste, nuclear waste, but I know it's important. And he was right. It is very important. And you've had Tom Carpenter from Hanford Challenge on your show, who's addressed some of these huge challenges that workers face out there. So there are people there doing their very best to keep us safe. But there's also this pressure from the federal government, from the Trump administration, to cut costs. And one of the places where they've now proposed to cut costs is in a facility called the Waste Encapsulation Storage Facility, or WESF, which contains not plutonium, but 1,936 capsules of very concentrated cesium and strontium. Now, this type of radiation is dangerous in potentially a different way, whereas plutonium is particularly dangerous if you inhale it. If it becomes airborne, it gets into your lung, it'll irradiate that lung tissue and do a lot of damage, potentially cause cancer, other ailments. Cesium and strontium capsules, on the other hand, have beta radiation, which can give you exterior radiation burns. It's sort of high velocity electrons that penetrate tissue more easily than the alpha radiation that comes from plutonium. So we're very concerned because we see the federal government proposing really significant cutbacks in their investment in addressing the waste encapsulation and storage facility. In fact, the president's budget zeroes out any effort to address this huge basin full of these capsules. And, you know, I think it would fill an entire radio show to talk through what would happen if there was a problem with the storage of these capsules at Hanford. It would become a national and international emergency if anything went wrong with this facility. And we feel a great deal of additional worry about this facility right now, because there was just a very large earthquake in Idaho. And it's quite far from Stanley, Idaho, which is near the epicenter of the earthquake, to Hanford. However, you know, we saw fault lines triggered through eastern Oregon, eastern Washington, in this 6.5 earthquake that happened in early April. So when that earthquake occurred, one of the first things that happened is, you know, we got very concerned about whether any facilities at Hanford might have been impacted, any of these aging facilities. And WESF was the first one that came to mind, this waste encapsulation storage facility. Luckily, nothing seems to have shaken loose at Hanford, but it was sort of a very powerful warning shot that we need to move as quickly and efficiently as possible towards removing these very radioactive capsules from an aging basin filled with water, with degrading concrete, and to get those into a much stabler form of storage at Hanford until they can be dealt with in a more holistic way. So that's another element that we'll be talking about in this webinar coming up on the 28th. But I wanted to just put that out there for your listeners that, you know, as we deal with COVID-19, we need to guard against major cost-cutting shortcuts from the federal government in dealing with Hanford's nuclear waste, because they are poised to be making decisions that will last for decades, if not millennia. And the stakes are very high. And one thing we're trying to do is to work with partner organizations like Heart of America Northwest, Hanford Challenge, but also with the folks from Yakima Nation's Environmental Restoration Waste Management Program. They have very deep, long knowledge going back through the tenure of the late Dr. Russell Jim, who really brought an intense regional focus from people from all walks of life to Hanford. And he would say over and over, you know, Yakima Nation works hard to hold up their end of the treaty. And he would sort of say, you know, in a kind but pointed way, that it sometimes they felt like they were having to hold up our side of the treaty as well, meaning the settler side. And Hanford is a really, really vital place for drinking water, for downstream communities, for irrigation. There's crops grown all around Hanford. And, of course, for the people of Yakima Nation and other Columbia River tribes who have used this place from for time immemorial, whether that's for fishing or hunting or even inhabiting Hanford. So having this very high level of risk with the waste encapsulation storage facility at Hanford, it should be drawing national attention, and it should be a very high priority for cleaning it up. And yet somehow in the 2021 budget from the president's budget, we saw the line item for waste encapsulation storage facility actually go to zero. That was very alarming to see, and something that we hope we can correct by, you know, raising public awareness of the importance of addressing Hanford's most dangerous facilities.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFT LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper, and we're talking now about the one of the most toxic places in the United States, the Hanford or in the world, Hanford Nuclear Reservation, and some real problems that the proponents for cleaning up Hanford have been facing with the Trump administration, who wants to cut everything out of the budget that would really maybe make that someday a safer place. What can people do to help to make sure that this facility that that Trump wants to zero out its budget, how can listeners become involved in helping to make sure that this facility does get cleaned up?
Yeah, we're at the very beginning of that. And one of the things that we can do now is to encourage the federal government, where they are proposing to stabilize some structures, to move quickly towards doing that. So there's a petition on our website. It doesn't pertain to the waste encapsulation storage facility yet, but you know, that focuses on three other facilities that have significant plutonium contamination and are also at risk of collapse. And your listeners might remember one of the Purex tunnels collapsing in 2017 that created, you know, national news, and it was an emergency, and they had to fill it with grout to stabilize it. This is sort of a similar situation, where there are three facilities that the federal government has identified as being at risk of collapse and having plutonium. And so this is really the first thing that's out of the gate, is to address those plutonium facilities. It'll be a longer haul to try to essentially get Department of Energy back on the path with WESF of addressing that contamination. What's remarkable about WESF is, you know, the federal government was working on planning for building a new facility to take those capsules of very concentrated cesium and strontium, and to remove them and put them in dry cask storage, which is a much safer, much more stable way of ensuring that they do not get overheated or have an impact that releases contamination into the environment, or anything that's born on the wind or in the water. So that is something that will be happening in coming months, where we'll, in all likelihood, be reaching out to your listeners, our members, to make sure that the federal government gets back on track with removing those capsules and doesn't propose delaying it for 10 years or more. And this came forward from a really excellent Tri-City Herald story, and even prompted a very harsh editorial from the Tri-City Herald, saying that the federal government was making a severe mistake by not accelerating and really focusing on these aging facilities for urgent cleanup.
Well, it's nice to see that there's some support for really cleaning up Hanford now coming from the Tri-Cities, because for so long they were really attached to having Hanford be the way it was.
Yeah, and I think it was a bit of a wake-up call to see the federal government float the idea of not removing those capsules for another 10 years. And if that wasn't enough, right in the midst of that, there was this really significant earthquake in Idaho, in a place that has never, at least humans have not recorded, an earthquake of that size at that time. So many of Hanford's structures are built for a certain level of earthquake, which is not as large as the one that just happened in Idaho.
Well, since you suggest that this would take a full hour of the show to talk about, I think we should plan on talking about it again maybe in the next few weeks.
That sounds great, yeah.
Yeah, so we'll talk about it maybe in June. We can set up another time and really delve into it. And by that time, either if we're done with social distancing, I can have you and Tom on together. And if not, then we will figure out how to do it by Zoom.
Yes, Hanford is a topic that could definitely fill a full hour. And, you know, we could talk in more depth at that time about some of the steps that are needed to address some of the really high-risk facilities at Hanford. But I just, you know, definitely want to take a moment just to say thank you for the opportunity to share this with your listeners. through KBOO. It's been a challenging time for people to keep track of what's going on in their own lives, much less to have the time and energy to devote to something like ensuring that the federal government wasn't reneging on its promise to protect downstream communities from Hanford's pollution.
Actually, I'm really glad that KBOO had the foresight to have a contingency plan in case we did have to socially isolate. And so we haven't had to go off the air like some other stations around the country have. So we're still here. In the last few moments, Dan, I just want to talk about how the pandemic is affecting your work at Columbia Riverkeeper. I've talked to several friends who work in nonprofits, and it seems like they're busier than ever, even though they're working from home. So how are you operating, and how is your legal team managing to deal with what they have to take on?
Yeah, it's been challenging for, you know, for really our members to maintain a focus on all of these different disparate areas where the Trump administration is pushing really major setbacks or rollbacks for projects that we're concerned about. For instance, you know, in this show alone, we spanned considering what's happening with these pipelines, where FERC is considering pushing forward approvals for huge fracked gas pipeline projects that would really dramatically impact the communities where they would be sited. And then we talked about radioactive fracking waste, three words I never thought I would be saying all in one fell swoop, much less three words that would pertain to Oregon and a beautiful place like Arlington. So, and then, you know, spanning those issues and connecting them even with what's going on at Hanford, which is a multi-decade-long cleanup process that's at real risk of stalling out unless the public gets very engaged. So what we're trying to do is to curate and to ensure that we are keeping our members informed about the most important things that are happening while respecting and really appreciating that people all over the Northwest are doing their very best to try to take care of each other and to take care of their communities in so many different ways that we see people volunteering and stepping up. So some of what we have to do here is to leave bookmarks along the way of different mistakes that may have been made when it comes to protecting the environment, protecting clean air, clean water, healthy fishing grounds. These are values that will be very important to people in any case of what happens with COVID-19.
Well, Dan, we certainly appreciate all the work that you're doing and that Columbia Riverkeeper is doing. And even if we're fighting this bizarre pandemic that we never imagined we'd be living through. So thanks a whole lot.
Thank you.
Today, we've been talking with Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our other KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping us volunteers make the best radio possible during this pandemic. Because the COVID-19 pandemic has forced us to cancel our spring pledge drive, which would be going on right now, we are asking you, our listeners, to help us if you can by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership. We understand that these times are hard for us all and that many of you are in no position to give away any money, but if you can, we really appreciate it. You can donate on our website, kboo.fm, by clicking on the Donate button in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk with climate scientist Heather Price about the lessons we are learning about pollution reduction in the wake of this pandemic. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with my favorite tune by John Prine. Thanks for listening, and stay safe and wash your hands.
You can't live together, you can't live alone. Considering the weather, oh my, how you've grown. From the men in the factories to the wild kangaroo, like those birds of a feather, they're gathering together and feeling exactly like you. They got mesmerized by lullabies and limbo danced in pairs. Please lock that door. It don't make much sense, that common sense don't make no sense no more. Just between you and me, it's like pulling when you are to be shoved. Like a nun with her head in the oven. Please don't tell me that this really wasn't enough. One of these days, one of these nights, you take off your hat and they'll read you your rights. You'll wanna get high every time you feel low. Hey, Queen Isabella, stay away from that fella. He'll just get you into trouble, you know. But they came here by boats, they came here by plane. They blistered their hands and they burned out their brain. All dreaming a dream that'll never come true. Hey, don't give me no trouble, or I'll call up my double. We'll play piggy in the middle with you. You'll get mesmerized by alibis and limbo dancing prayers. Please lock that door. It don't make much sense, that common sense don't make no sense no more. It don't make much sense, that common sense don't make no sense no more.